The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Memes of Ascent, by Robert A. Caro, continued, Cassette 4, Side 2. And Johnson was, of course, seeing Red James, too. Indeed, throughout this period, he was quite frequently bringing to see James the attorney who was handling the KTBC application. During all this period of time, Alvin Wirtz used to come to Washington. I regarded Alvin Wirtz very highly, and he and Lyndon Johnson and I would get together and have a highball and go out to dinner, just shoot the bull about things, occasionally go over to Lyndon's house. I would be working maybe at the FCC. Along about 4:30 in the afternoon, I'd get a call from LBJ, and he'd say, "Alvin has come to town. He wants to see you and wants you to come on over, and we'll have a couple of drinks." "Did Wirtz represent them in the FCC matter?" James was asked. "Yes, I'm sure he did." And, of course, this was the period during which Johnson was making his late-night telephone calls to James. Whatever the reason, when Durr and James are discussing KTBC, even while Durr is saying, "I never got any pressures at all from Johnson," there emerges, not only in James's own words, but in Durr's as well, an attitude that a disapproving observer was to describe as government between friends. Whenever in later years Durr was asked about the KTBC application, he was quick to point out that it was in Lady Bird's name, and to say that Lyndon never had a thing to do with it. Bird came to me and said there was a chance to buy this radio station in Austin, and as I recall, she said for about $22,000. She either had the money or could borrow the money on this inheritance she had of the Autauga County property. She could raise that much money, and she wanted to know whether I thought it would be a wise investment. So I gave her some figures on the earnings of well-run stations at the time. They were making an awful lot of money. I heard generally around the FCC that this was a very poorly run station. I remember our engineers complaining about the engineering operations and getting all, frequencies and things of that sort. I told her that it seemed to me if she could get that station on its feet and get it well managed, it ought to be a very good investment. There was nothing wrong with Bird's visit, Durr says. Now, there wasn't any skullduggery that I ever saw at the FCC. It was more or less the routine approval of the purchase of a station. This had to be approved by the FCC, but nobody else was in the picture. There was nothing wrong with that, Durr says. And James, whom Bird also used to visit, makes the same point. She used to come down and see me quite often and discuss matters, as she had a perfect right to do, unless they were adversary matters. It's possible, of course, that during all their dinners and telephone conversations with Durr and James, Wirtz or Johnson did not mention the radio station to the two FCC officials. But Mrs. Johnson did, and after her visits, Durr and James spoke to lower-level FCC staffers about KTBC, which, whether Durr and James intended this or not, would have signaled these staffers that their superiors were personally interested in the matter. Not that all staffers needed to read such indirect signals. Lyndon Johnson may not, as Durr and James maintain, have been talking to them directly about KTBC, but his contention that he never intervened with the FCC would have fallen strangely on the ears of James Barr, who, as an official of the FCC's Standard Broadcast Division all during the 1940s, had to pass on some of Mrs. Johnson's applications. One day, while he was considering one of these applications, his telephone rang. When he picked it up, he found Mrs. Johnson's husband, Congressman Johnson, on the line. "He wanted to get a radio station, and what I remember is he wouldn't take no for an answer," Barr recalls. "I can still hear him when I tried to explain. Now, Mr. Barr, the thing that impressed me was that he was on a first-name basis with Red James." And although Johnson, Durr, and James were reticent about telephone calls they may or may not have made, or influence they may or may not have used, Tommy Corcoran, never reticent about anything, was not. "I helped him out with that," the KTBC application, "all up and down the line," he said. And when he was asked whether the fact that Lyndon Johnson was a congressman important to the FCC, had helped his wife obtain a radio license, Corcoran reacted at first only with silence and a look of contempt that someone should have to ask so obvious a question. Finally, he growled, "How do you think these things work? These guys, FCC staffers, have been around. You don't have to spell things out for them." Moreover, about one significant point, Durr is incorrect. If nobody else was in the picture, that wasn't because nobody else wanted to be. While J.M. West had been anxious to enter the radio business, his sons in Kingsbury had not seemed to care one way or the other. Apparently feeling that Wirtz's silence was a signal that the sale to the Wests was never going to receive FCC approval, and fearing that behind-the-scenes maneuvering might be taking place in Washington, Ulmer, representing the station's owners, had in 1942 let it be known in the Austin business community that if a new, firm offer for KTBC was received, the West option might be circumvented, surrendered, or sold for a token amount. Several Austin businessmen thereupon expressed interest in KTBC at the same time that Mrs. Johnson was doing so. One prospective purchaser was William Drake, a lumber company president who would later become mayor of the city. Other businessmen recall that Drake was quite determined to acquire the station. Edward Joseph, one of the city's leading realtors and owner of a clothing store, says, "Bill Drake made an offer on the station. He made an offer on it, but Lyndon just reached out and got it from under him." Joseph adds that because of that, they sort of fell out, and for a long time they were on the outs because of that. Another businessman, more sophisticated in the ways of politics than Drake, took his experience with the FCC and Johnson more philosophically. He was William J. Lawson, a former Texas Secretary of State who by 1942 had become a successful businessman in Austin. In partnership with two other businessmen, Lawson had recently acquired an FCC construction permit, the first step toward obtaining a license, for KBWD, a 500-watt station in Brownwood, Texas, and it had proved to be a lucrative business deal. Obtaining a permit for a station in Brownwood, Lawson had found, was simple. He had simply sent in the application, and back, very quickly as he recalls, had come FCC approval. The two businessmen, impressed by the financial possibilities of small radio stations, "This thing's a gold mine," one said, bought out his share even before the license for KBWD was granted, for what Lawson considered a handsome profit. In 1942, Lawson recalls, "I wanted to do the same thing in Austin with KTBC." But, he found, becoming the owner of a station in Austin was not as simple as becoming the owner of a station in Brownwood. After making a tentative agreement with Ulmer, Lawson sent the FCC a preliminary inquiry, not even an application, it never got to the application stage, as to how to proceed, but he says, "Before I could get anything done, I got this odd letter, a form letter, not even a dictated letter, that had the effect of discouraging him from proceeding further." Telephoning a veteran Capitol Hill staff member, D. Roland Potter, Lawson asked him to find out from his contacts at the FCC what had happened. Potter called back, telling Lawson that his contact said that Congressman Johnson was in to see us. They said that Congressman Johnson had indicated an interest in the license, and based on the information he had given them, I, Lawson, was financially unstable. "Their excuse didn't make any sense," Lawson says. "They had already issued me one permit, you know." Why would they find him suitable for one station and unsuitable for another? His financial situation, he says, had only improved since the Brownwood application. Lawson was very far from a political neophyte. He had been, in fact, a key strategist in Governor O'Daniel's victory over Johnson the previous year. And being no neophyte, Lawson knew that this time Johnson had beaten him. He dropped any further effort to obtain KTBC. "I never made an issue out of it because I would have been fighting with the congressman, and he already had made his point with the commission," he explains. Despite Durr's assertion, therefore, other prospective purchasers were in the picture, or rather might have been if not for Lyndon Johnson's entree, his access to the commission's ear. Johnson, Lawson believed, had told the commission that Lawson was financially unstable. Untrue though this statement was, the commission may have accepted it, because there was no one to refute it. In courts of law, to the extent that only one side in a case has access to a judge, to that extent justice is diminished, since in such an ex parte proceeding, the other side cannot be heard. The power of regulatory agencies, such as the Federal Communications Commission, is, in not a few respects, the power of a judge. But before the commission, in the case of KTBC, the other side was not heard. The Johnson side, Lyndon Johnson, Lady Bird Johnson, Alvin Wirtz, could get appointments with an FCC commissioner and a top FCC staffer to discuss the Johnson application in person. The opposing applicant could get only a form letter, not even a dictated letter. Whatever the explanation, the shift in the FCC's attitude toward KTBC was dramatic after Lady Bird Johnson submitted her application to purchase the station. The 5 years during which the original owners had been dealing with the FCC had been 5 years of delays and red tape, or delays and unfavorable rulings, of slowness in every aspect of the bureaucratic process. From the moment the owners agreed to sell to Mrs. Johnson, red tape vanished, all rulings were favorable, and slowness was replaced by speed. The speed was evident not only in the fact that her application to purchase KTBC, submitted to the FCC on January 23, 1943, was approved on February 16, 1943, in just over 3 weeks. It was evident also when later that year she applied to change the conditions under which the station operated. For the previous owners, changing the restrictions had seemed an insuperable obstacle. For Mrs. Johnson, changing the restrictions was no obstacle at all. In June 1943, she applied to the FCC for permission to operate 24 hours a day, at a new frequency, 590 on the dial, a frequency so much more desirable than the old that the move alone would transform KTBC into a much more viable and valuable property. Not only would it make KTBC the first station that Austin listeners could get on their dials, but 590 was at the opposite uncluttered end of the dial from 1150, an end so uncluttered in the Austin area, in fact, that KTBC would now be heard not only in Austin, but in no fewer than 38 surrounding counties throughout central Texas. Her application, abetted by a Wirtz-engineered application for daytime hours, submitted by WTAW earlier that same month, was filed with the FCC on June 25th. It was approved on July 20th. Was Lyndon Johnson's influence responsible for the change? Mrs. Johnson, Red James emphasizes, had a perfect right to discuss matters with him unless they were adversary matters. There was an adversary in this matter because, as James was, perhaps inadvertently to recall, the frequency he, Johnson, wanted to change over to was a frequency where the dominant station was WOW in Omaha, Nebraska, and KWOW's broadcasts had previously reached south into Texas, a fact which KWOW used in selling advertisers airtime. I think, James was to recall, his lawyer talked to the lawyers for WOW and asked them if they would oppose it if he applied to go on that frequency. They were a little upset about this. But as James's own statement thus confirms, the fact that there was an adversary did not deter him from discussing the matter with Lyndon Johnson, and it didn't deter James from discussing the matter with other FCC officials. And it didn't deter James from giving Lady Bird Johnson advice as to how to proceed, advice that may have carried with it the strong implication that the judges before whom her application would be argued, if the adversary opposed her, would not be wholly unsympathetic to her cause. James was to say that he discussed the case with a top FCC counsel and engineer. They looked at the thing and said, "We don't see any particular problems about it," and I told Mrs. Johnson that. I told Lady Bird. I said, "Why don't you apply for it? You know, if they set you down for a hearing, so they set you down for a hearing in a consolidated proceeding." So they applied for it and got it. The commission granted it. They applied for it. Not strange that the Johnsons decided to do so after the chief aide to one of the judges told them in advance, "Why don't you apply for it?" The hearing would be a quasi-judicial proceeding, and a judge is not supposed to hear one side of a case without the other side having an opportunity to respond, as had been done. In addition to the lawyers for KWOW, at least two other persons were upset at the changes granted KTBC. After running into James Ulmer at a broadcasting convention, Leonard Marks, a Washington attorney who had left the FCC and was now representing KTBC, reported to Johnson that Ulmer was saying that he had completed all the engineering on 590 and that you came in and stole it from him. Ulmer added, according to a memo from Marks, that he would not write the story, but whether he did so or not, somebody else probably would. Also angry was Elliot Roosevelt, the president's son, who had gone into the radio business in Texas in partnership with oil man Sid Richardson. Elliot's relationship with his father was strained at this time, and he was receiving no help from the White House with his radio interests. On August 31, 1943, after having lunch with Elliot, John Conley reported to Johnson that an angry Elliot had said during the lunch that there was a controversy when KTBC got nighttime operations, but that Mr. Johnson had the skids greased with the commission. Was Lyndon Johnson's influence, influence that translated into access and entree into inside information and advance information, even more deeply at work? Had he known in advance something that no one else knew? Had he known, even before his wife bought KTBC, that if she bought it, the FCC would change the conditions that had hamstrung the station in the past? Lady Bird Johnson purchased KTBC in February, and in June made her application, the application that was so rapidly approved for the change in hours and frequency. That was fast enough. But had Lyndon Johnson known even before June that such an application would be approved? In April, Lyndon and Lady Bird asked the Dallas radio announcer, who had been the MC of Johnson's traveling roadshow in the 1941 campaign, Harfield Whedon, to become manager of their new station, offering him a 10% share of the profits. Whedon was reluctant to accept because he felt that under the existing FCC restrictions on the station's operation, profits were unlikely. "You couldn't really make much money with just a daytime station," he says. But he also recalls Johnson assured him that if I took the job, I would not be bothered with that. The restrictions were going to be lifted very shortly. Johnson said, "Look, the frequency is going to be changed. We're going to go full-time. I have it in the works right now." He specifically told Whedon that the lifting of the restrictions was all set, and Whedon believed him because, Whedon says, Johnson understood that the restrictions were an insurmountable handicap. "Frankly," Whedon says, "I don't feel he would have bought it if he didn't know he was going to get those changes." The Johnsons' meeting with Whedon took place only 2 months after they had purchased the station, but Johnson was saying that the changes that would transform it were already all set, as indeed they very shortly proved to be. Whether or not Lyndon Johnson had known of the changes in advance, they totally transformed the property his wife had purchased. She had, in effect, purchased 1150 on the radio dial. After FCC approval of her application for increased broadcasting hours and a new frequency, when a listener turned his dial to 1150, all he heard was static. There was no longer any station at that spot on the dial. The station was now at 590, which meant that it sounded different, louder, clearer. And it was on at night when more people wanted to listen to it. Only its call letters were the same. Otherwise, within months of the time Mrs. Johnson had bought a station so cheaply, that station no longer existed. And at the earliest possible moment, as soon as the war ended and necessary materials became available, the transformation became even greater. In 1945, the FCC allowed KTBC to quintuple its power from 1,000 to 5,000 watts, a change that meant the station could be heard in 63 counties. And if others had known that it could be so totally altered, would it have been so cheap? Might there not have been other bidders for so desirable a radio property? And would these other bidders have been so easily deterred as William Lawson had been? Indeed, would Lawson have been so easily deterred? Indeed, would the original owners have been willing to sell for so little, a 24-hour-a-day station that was first on the dial and that boomed out all over Austin and throughout Central Texas? Would the owners have had to sell if the property they owned had been the property into which it had now been so rapidly transformed by the FCC? But no others knew, no others could know for sure, just as they couldn't be advised by a key figure in the FCC that they shouldn't worry unduly about a conflict with KWOW. And so there were no other bids for KTBC, and the owners of KTBC were willing to sell cheap. Lady Bird Johnson flew down to Austin, where, a station employee recalls, she took one look at the layout and said, "I don't know much about radio, but I do know about cleaning house." She bought a pair of overalls, a bunch of brooms and mops, and some soap, and for a solid week she worked on that little walk-up two-room station until it fairly sparkled. She studied KTBC's contracts with its advertisers to determine how much airtime the station owed them and how much money the advertisers owed the station. She began trying to straighten out its books, which were a mess. In the legend which would be repeated to reporters year after year, these efforts were what turned the fortunes of KTBC around. "She worked 18 hours a day for 5 months before we brought the station into the black," the employee says. Mrs. Johnson herself takes great pride in her industry during those early months. The staff was infected with a sense of failure and uncertainty, and sloppiness had become a way of life in that little area, so we just gave it a good, thorough cleaning up. I think it kind of improved everybody's spirits. It certainly did mine. Mr. Johnson flew up to New York, where he called on William S. Paley, the president of the CBS Radio Network, and asked for a CBS affiliation, which would allow KTBC to carry the network's famous, nationally known shows, on which advertisers would be more eager to purchase time than on local shows, and for which higher rates could be charged. The affiliation was vital to KTBC, and Johnson knew it. "This is life and death to us," he wrote a former aide, Gene Latimer. At the time of his visit to Paley, the Federal Communications Commission was determinedly attempting to reduce the network's control of independent stations, and Paley was leading an almost frantic fight to persuade Congress to reduce the FCC's authority over them by amending the law, Sam Rayburn's law, that had established the commission. This was only the latest in a series of running battles between the networks and the FCC, battles in which the networks were continually appealing to Congress for help. Did the fact that this applicant for an affiliation was a congressman, Sam Rayburn's boy, have anything to do with CBS's decision in the matter? Paley and Frank Stanton were to cast the story in folksy terms. Paley would tell David Halberstam that Johnson had simply appeared in his office one day without an appointment. His secretary had come in to see him, Paley said, and announced that there was a very tall Texan waiting out there in a big hat and boots who said he was a congressman. Paley went out to meet him, and the Texan, according to Paley, had said, "Mr. Paley, I have this here ticket for a 250-watt station in Austin, and I'd like to join as a CBS affiliate." Paley had sent the tall Texan to Frank Stanton, CBS director of research, who also handled some affiliate matters. Stanton says he looked at a map, found there was room for an affiliated station in Austin, and gave Johnson the affiliation. Journalists may have regarded this story skeptically, but they felt they could not disprove it. In fact, however, it is possible to know what would have happened if a non-congressional station owner in Austin had applied for a CBS affiliation. For a non-congressional station owner had applied, in fact, several times. The other Austin radio station, KNOW, had been energetically attempting for years to secure a CBS affiliation. Every attempt had been rejected by CBS because the network already had an affiliate, KTSA, in San Antonio, which could be heard in Austin. CBS's decision in regard to Lyndon Johnson's request may have had nothing to do with his political influence, but his political influence had everything to do with many of the advertisers who bought time on KTBC. The backers who had arranged for money to be contributed to his political campaigns now arranged for money to be contributed to his radio station. Herman Brown gave him some advertisers. Johnson told Harfield Wheaton to go to the Houston offices of the American General Insurance Company, which had most of Brown and Root's insurance business, and American General's president, Gus Wortham, purchased 15 minutes of airtime every night. Why did Wortham advertise on KTBC? "We twisted his arm," George Brown was to recall years later with a smile. The New York attorney Ed Weissel Sr., the chief financier of Johnson's campaign funding efforts in the Northeast, who was powerful in both political and entertainment circles, gave him some advertisers. The Interstate Theater chain, for example, bought 15 minutes a night. Many of these advertisers were, or during this period would become, connected with Everett Looney and Edward A. Clark, principals in the Austin law firm of Looney and Clark. Ed Clark was coming to be known, as Alvin Wirtz was already known, as a lawyer to go to in Austin if you wanted something from the federal government. Clark, a power in his own right, had never been intimidated by Johnson. He was too independent to take orders from any politician, and too astute. Of all the men with whom Lyndon Johnson was associated in Texas, Clark was the one who, over the years, acquired and held the most power. He expressed the same philosophy as Herman Brown. If he invested in, bought a ticket on, in his phrase, a politician, he wanted a return on that investment. And through the radio station, he was to get it. What Johnson wanted was advertising revenues. What Clark wanted was recognition as a lawyer with influence in Washington. And both got what they wanted. One of the powerful Texans with whom Clark would be associated for years was Howard E. Butt of Corpus Christi, owner of the statewide HEB chain of grocery stores. "I knew Mr. Butt's interest in politics," Clark says, and he recalls, "he knew Butt needed someone to help with problems he was having with federal agencies in Washington, particularly during those wartime years with the Office of Price Administration. So," Clark says, "he advised Mr. Butt to advertise on KTBC." Because the station's records have not been released, it is difficult to learn any details about Butt's advertising, but it may have been done through companies whose products were sold in HEB stores and who would advertise on KTBC and mention HEB in their ads. In a letter written on October 27, 1943, Clark told Johnson, "I am today writing to Corpus so that Howard Butt will contact the advertisers whose products he sells at his stores in Austin so that he will have an opportunity to get coverage here." Butt soon found out how wise Clark's advice could be. In 1944, when the OPA was limiting each distributor's number of cases of grapefruit that could be harvested and packed in the Rio Grande Valley, Johnson intervened and persuaded the agency to allocate Butt 150,000 extra cases. "I was happy to be able to call Mr. Howard Butt after our conversation about the grapefruit today," Clark wrote Johnson on February 3, 1944, and indeed everyone involved got something out of this arrangement. Butt got 150,000 extra cases of grapefruit and the profits from selling them. Clark got recognition as an attorney with influence in Washington. KTBC got advertising revenues. Butts was not the only company that Ed Clark advised to advertise on KTBC. Clark already had a connection with the General Electric Company, and on October 27, 1943, he was able to write Johnson that General Electric's popular World News Today program would be going on KTBC. "Thanks for the wonderful job on GE," Johnson replied. "That's the most important thing that has been accomplished lately." Among Clark's contacts were major oil companies who worked together to exert political influence in Washington. One was Gulf Oil. Gulf wasn't a client of Looney and Clark, Clark says, "but I had friends there. I spoke to them about it," advertising on KTBC, "and they understood. This wasn't a Sunday school proposition. This was business." Not all the advertisers came through Clark. Wirtz was on a retainer from Humble Oil, a subsidiary of Standard Oil. Humble sponsored football games on the CBS network under an arrangement in which the giant oil company selected the stations which carried the games. KTBC was selected. Wirtz had other clients that wanted things from the federal government, and they too began to advertise on KTBC. Local businessmen who wanted to obtain or keep contracts with the army camps near Austin or with the huge Bergstrom Air Force Base got the idea, which was soon being openly discussed in the Austin business community. As one businessman puts it, "Everybody knew that a good way to get Lyndon to help you with government contracts was to advertise over his radio station." One example was the Jack's Power Saw Company. For one period, the only period for which records are available, the Jack's Company sponsored a six-day-a-week half-hour program. The purpose of the ads was not, says one Jack's associate, to attract business from listeners. Jack's did little business in Austin, the associate says. Rather, the purpose was to enable Jack's to sell power saws to the Army and Navy for use all over the country. In 1948, moreover, the company wanted to expand and needed a $1,250,000 loan from the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. When the application was filed, Johnson quietly spoke to at least one member of the RFC board, Vice Chairman Harley Heise, about it, and instructed Walter Jenkins to make subtle follow-up calls to remind the RFC that the congressman wanted the loan approved. Jenkins did so, and as soon as the next meeting of the RFC board had ended, Heise hurried to a telephone and called Jenkins to tell him that the loan had gone through. Jenkins communicated the good news to Jack's through its attorney, Everett Looney of Looney and Clark. Other businessmen observed the pattern and followed it. Although they were ostensibly buying airtime, what they were really buying was political influence. They were buying, and Lyndon Johnson was selling. Lyndon Johnson was always to maintain that his wife's radio interests were totally divorced from politics, and that indeed he, the politician in the family, had absolutely nothing to do either with acquiring KTBC's license or, once it was licensed, with its operations. And Mrs. Johnson was indeed an integral part of the business. David Benjamin, who had been a salesman for KTBC under the previous ownership and stayed on, was impressed with the speed with which Mrs. Johnson brought order to the previously chaotic activities of the station's salesman. "Mrs. Johnson knew who I had called on, and the results of the call," Benjamin says, "and she complimented me, or urged him on to greater efforts." Elizabeth Goldschmidt was not the only member of the Johnson circle who expressed admiration for Lady Bird's diligence, energy, and business acumen. Leonard Marks says, after emphasizing that it was her station, "don't let anybody tell you to the contrary," "over the years, as the station prospered, I would go up to visit them at their home on 30th Place on a Sunday. She would have the reports of the week's sales, the list of expenses, and we'd go over them. She could read a balance sheet the way a truck driver reads a road map." In later years, moreover, Mrs. Johnson's role in the station's management greatly expanded, and her husband, in making major business decisions, began to rely more on her judgment, to a point at which Walter Jenkins, who was active in KTBC's affairs, said, in words echoed by members of the Austin business community, "I believe he came to trust her judgment almost as much as his own." Ed Clark himself says, "He trusted her judgment because she was never emotional, always calm. He would get angry, he would get mad, cuss. She never got emotional. This is too small to get mad over. She was always cool, weighing things just on the basis of what made sense in business." Nevertheless, Mrs. Johnson's ability as a businesswoman was not the crucial factor in the acquisition of the station, or, once it was acquired, in its early growth. It was not Mrs. Johnson who negotiated with E.G. Kingsbury for his option to purchase the station. "I'm not sure I even knew there was a Mrs. Johnson," Kingsbury was to say. It wasn't Mrs. Johnson who negotiated with the West brothers. It wasn't Mrs. Johnson who telephoned James Barr at the FCC Standard Broadcast Division and wouldn't take no for an answer. It wasn't Mrs. Johnson who saw William Paley and Frank Stanton in New York. It wasn't Mrs. Johnson who dealt with Ed Clark and who procured an extra 150,000 cases of grapefruit for H.E. Butt and who similarly worked within the government on behalf of other businesses which purchased advertising time on KTBC. It wasn't Mrs., but Mr. Johnson. Lyndon Johnson had worked at politics for years to achieve power. Now he was working at politics to make money. And he made it. Under its former owners, KTBC's income from the sale of advertising had been about $2,600 per month. During the first few months that Mrs. Johnson owned it, the income rose only to a little over $3,000 per month. But in December of 1943, the first substantial revenues from the CBS affiliation began coming in. The support of Herman Brown, Alvin Wirtz, and Ed Clark was beginning to be felt, and advertising income rose to $5,645 for the month. It rose more, rose faster and faster. In 1944, KTBC's average income from advertisers was $13,500 a month. In 1945, it was $15,300 a month. In 1946, it was $22,700 a month, more than the total amount Mrs. Johnson had paid for the station. In 1946 alone, the revenues from the property she had bought 3 years before for $17,500 totaled $272,500. Profits after expenses were also impressive. Mrs. Johnson soon began taking an annual salary. It was $21,500 by 1948, and the ownership also may have been withdrawing funds from the business by other methods. Since sufficiently detailed KTBC records are not open, it has not been possible to determine the total amount of such disbursements, but one in 1947 was apparently $80,000. Despite such withdrawals, however, KTBC's assets mounted rapidly. The end of the first era of the Johnson financial empire, the era in which his principal holding was stationed KTBC, Austin, may be dated as 1952, because in that year it expanded into television, and its size and wealth soared to dramatically higher levels. But even before it entered that new era, the station's assets, on December 31, 1951, were $439,000. Until the end of his life, whenever the subject of the vast growth of the LBJ Company and associated business enterprises was raised, Lyndon Johnson would emphasize that he owned none of it. All that is owned by Mrs. Johnson. I don't have any interest in government-regulated industries of any kind and never have had. These statements were, with rare exceptions, accepted by the press. Listing the holdings of the LBJ Company when he became president, the Washington Star agreed that these holdings are not the president's. Presumably, the journalists who looked into the Johnson finances did not examine the implication of Texas law, particularly the state's community property law, and most particularly the rights under that law of the spouse of a person who purchases a property with her own separate funds, such as an inheritance. Under that law, the spouse of that person, such as Lyndon Johnson, spouse of Lady Bird Johnson, who purchased KTBC with her own inheritance, has indeed no interest in that property. He owns none of it. The spouse does, however, have an interest in the income from that property. He owns half of that. James H. Rowe, Jr. recalls that one day after the radio station had been purchased, he, Johnson, and I were walking the streets and talking, and he pulled a piece of paper out of his pocket and said, "I want to show you what this station made last year." Soon he was showing those papers, year-end figures for KTBC, to many friends. While the figures were small at first, these men recall that they got bigger, much bigger, each year, and were joined by figures for other investments. Soon Johnson began pulling out columns of figures that together added up to his net financial worth. By 1948, the bottom line had seven figures on it. In that year, Lyndon Johnson began telling friends that he was a millionaire. In running KTBC, Lyndon Johnson was displaying the same intense involvement with every aspect of its affairs that was characteristic of his political career. Here is a letter to KTBC sales manager Willard Deason, one of many similar letters he wrote, from the man who said he was unfamiliar with the affairs of the radio station. "Now, Bill, I'm convinced that we can put some permanent business on the books this week and next week if we will plan and concentrate on a specific few. Last week, none of our sales were really permanent, and the total sales for each person was very little more than his paycheck for the week. When this happens, we slip back and have trouble coming up. Show Jesse the attached letter I have written Jacob Schmidt, and suggest to him that you or he, or both of you, go with Sam and see Mr. Schmidt personally. I'd hoped you would present the deal you showed to Buttrees to Yerings after you'd reduced it in half, and would make some transcriptions of 8 or 10 word spots taken from Yerings' advertisements for them to listen to. I note instead you have pitched a Sunday program. I think Schmidt should be approached by asking him to give radio a fair test. In order to do this, he should give us a percentage of what he is now spending on the paper. We can do a better job for him, and we should contend to him that we can and will if he will give us a long-term opportunity. My idea would be that you and Jesse and Sam ought to get some Uncle Ezra transcriptions and some spot transcriptions taken from Yerings' newspaper ads and ask for a 30-minute meeting with Joel Simon, Leon, and Mr. Schmidt. You could do this because I requested you to, if you think it would be easier. I think we can and should sew up Ben Grieg, Lawler, Pruitt, Schmidt, Yerings, Red Arrow, Reynolds Penland, and Swearing and Armstrong in the next few days. Is there any chance of getting any steck business? Sincerely, Lyndon B. Johnson. P.S. Bill, I don't know who Jim can help us with, but I should say Levine's, Louis, Laves, and Ginsburg's if he's still on the other station. In recruiting a staff for KTBC, Johnson was using the same methods he had used in recruiting his political staff. There were, in Austin as in Washington, the charm and the promises deployed to persuade a man to leave his job and go to work for him. When handsome, ambitious Harfield Wheaton, already at 27, program director of WFAA, a prestigious station in Dallas, and a well-known radio personality throughout Texas, arrived in Austin, the Johnsons showed him KTBC's offices and equipment. "I have seen run-down radio stations in my day, but never anything to compare with KTBC," Wheaton was to recall. The studio was a shambles, and the equipment was third and fourth, maybe even fifth hand. My initial reaction was so awful I wanted to turn and go back to Dallas. But then he was to recall Johnson began to talk. "She was there, but he did most of the talking. And," he says, "he did quite a sales job on me." The congressman assured Wheaton that the station would have unlimited hours. Very shortly they would go full-time, and unlimited funds. No money would be spared to make it Austin's leading station. He promised Wheaton an employment contract which would give him not only security, but 10% of the station's profits, a promise which appealed to the young man since it would mean he was no longer merely a salaried employee. And Johnson promised Wheaton something that meant even more to him than money, a title, general manager, and the authority that went with it. "They would turn it over to me to operate as I saw fit. I could do anything I wanted in order to make it the station of their dreams." This was more like it, Wheaton was to say. The more Johnson talked, the more he felt that here was my great opportunity, a challenge that could pay off in the realization of my one remaining ambition, to be the manager of a successful radio station. Wheaton asked for the Johnson's assurance that he would be in charge, explaining, as he recalls, that since neither of them knew anything about the radio business, he had to be able to make decisions on his own. And the assurance was given. They gave me carte blanche to do whatever I wanted to do, because I explained to them that's part of the deal. Otherwise, I won't take the job. And then, once the man had gone to work for Johnson, there came, in Austin as in Washington, the change. It wasn't as abrupt at the radio station as it had been in the congressional office, because Lyndon Johnson, initially less knowledgeable about radio, was forced to rely on the knowledge of those he hired. At first, therefore, Wheaton found himself dealing primarily with Lady Bird. And Lady Bird, she is the most wonderful person in the world, he says, was helpful mostly by giving me encouragement. Wheaton did the hiring. He persuaded a friend, John Hicks, another young ambitious announcer in Dallas, to come to KTBC as chief announcer and program director. The vision that had been given to Whedon of unlimited funds for equipment turned out to be an exaggeration. He quickly found out, he recalls, that Lady Bird did not have the unlimited funds I thought she had. There was not, in fact, enough to purchase even a new, urgently needed transmitter. But Whedon persuaded another friend, a crack engineer from Dallas, to come to Austin and repair the old one. Then they moved to new offices in the Brown Building. To save money, Hicks recalls, we literally hand-carried that station from the business college. Lady Bird, she worked like a horse that day. Her husband? The congressman was never around when he had worked like that. Whedon realized that the most important thing was to get the station out of the red, but quick. To do so, to make the most of his great opportunity, he poured his talent and youthful energy into every phase of the station's operations. He hired two new salesmen, but supplemented their efforts by going out as a salesman himself, although selling was not his field. The repaired transmitter and the new 590 wavelength gave KTBC a powerful, clear signal, and to make sure the station sounded professional, Whedon himself delivered those newscasts that Hicks couldn't, so that KTBC had professional voices. Establishing new rates for advertising, he persuaded KNOW not to undercut them, so that both stations would get more revenue. He selected and purchased the records for the music shows. He designed new stationery and promotional material for mailings. To make contacts with the Austin businessmen to whom he was trying to sell time, he put on quiz shows at luncheons of the Rotary, Kiwanis, Lions, and other clubs, even delivering a 5-minute newscast at Rotary meetings. His days began at 6, because at 7:15 the Wake Up with Wheaton show went on the air, and by that time he had to have written a newscast from the incoming teletype. As soon as he signed off at 8:30, he discussed the day's work with the salesman and dealt with the station's correspondents. By 10:30 he was out on the streets, calling on prospective clients, rushing back to the station to handle any problems. At 5:15 p.m. and again at 6 and 8 o'clock, to give a rest to Hicks, who had been doing the announcing and newscasts all day, he did 15-minute newscasts, and then, 14 hours after he had left for the station, drove home to handle more business. This, Whedon was to say, was the toughest schedule I had ever had in my life. But for a while, he says, all of us had that wonderful feeling of accomplishment, and also as we looked at the profit side of the ledger. By August 1943, KTBC showed its first profit, $18. By October, the monthly profit was hundreds of dollars. And after the CBS programs began coming through that autumn, it was thousands. Gradually, however, the wonderful feeling faded. For the vision of unlimited funds to improve KTBC was not the only promise that was not being honored. The promised written contract with its 10% of KTBC's profits did not materialize. During the first 6 months of the Johnson ownership, the congressman himself did not come to Austin often, but when he did, Whedon would bring up the subject and the congressman would stall. Lyndon would never give me a contract because he could never decide if the 10% was before or after taxes, Whedon says. In 1944, despite the station's substantial profits, Whedon was still receiving no money other than his salary. That inadequate salary, so much lower than his salary at his former station, that he had agreed to accept only because of the promise of a share of the profits. But while the percentage had not been forthcoming, the other important promise that had motivated Whedon to come to KTBC, carte blanche, the assurance that he would really be in charge, had for a time been kept. As the station became stronger, however, that promise too began to be broken. Whedon had been consulting almost daily with Mrs. Johnson. The two of them had been getting along very well. As for the congressman, during the first 6 months or so, he left Whedon alone. But once we got into the fact that we were making money and it looked like we were really on our way, that changed, Whedon was to say. He felt that the change was also due to the Johnsons' realization that this thing was a hell of a lot, a great moneymaker, and it was going to be bigger and bigger. Whatever the reason, I did not have the carte blanche at the end of that time I had had in the early days. This book is continued on Cassette 5, Side 1.